From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour today, a conversation with NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple Raston. She visits Grinnell this week to discuss her unique role working with the FBI and CIA. Temple Raston will discuss the fundamental changes in the threat of terrorism. Then in the second half hour, Iowa comedian Nathan Timmel. Timmel has just returned from another trip to Iraq. He'll tell us about this latest trip on behalf of the U.S. military to boost morale and the changes he's noticed since the redeployment of large numbers of U.S. troops out of the country. That's all coming up this hour, right after a look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Eastern Iowa stand-up comedian Nathan Timmel. Timmel has just returned to the States after his third tour in Iraq, entertaining U.S. troops. Timmel will share his unique take on the handing over of power from U.S. to Iraqi forces. We'll get his thoughts on Middle East reaction to protests over a Ground Zero community center in New York and the planned burning of the Quran by a Florida minister. That's Eastern Iowa stand-up comedian Nathan Timmel, just back from Iraq, later on The Exchange today. First, though, a conversation with National Public Radio reporter Dina Temple Raston. Temple Raston is NPR's counterterrorism correspondent. She joined the NPR team in 2007. Before that, she served as a foreign correspondent for Bloomberg News in Asia. Temple Raston also served as Bloomberg's White House correspondent during both Clinton administrations. She is an award-winning author. Her first book, entitled A Death in Texas, about race in America, won the Barnes & Noble Discover Award and was chosen as one of The Washington Post's best books related to civil liberties and national security. Thursday, Dina Temple Raston will speak as part of Grinnell College's Rosenfield Program in Public Affairs. She will offer commentary entitled Behind the Scenes, Terrorism Cases After the Cold War. Iowa Public Radio's Jeff Schmidt spoke with Dina Temple Raston and began by asking her how she became NPR's counterterrorism correspondent.
It first started out as an FBI correspondent job, and I had written a book about the Lackawanna Six. You may recall those are the six guys who went to an al-Qaeda camp before the 9/11 attacks in Afghanistan and then came back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. They were from a small town, a small steel town just outside of Buffalo, New York. And so I wrote an entire book called The Jihad Next Door, which took a look at what it was like to be Muslim in America post 9/11. And I used these guys as a vehicle to show how to do that. And as it turns out, that sort of lined me up, because the FBI were the people who investigated them. That lined me up for the FBI correspondence job. And then naturally what flowed out of that is this counterterrorism position I have now.
You're based in New York. Why New York as opposed to maybe Washington?
You know, some of my bosses would ask the same question about that. But there's actually a lot more rubber meets the road here in New York in terms of terrorism. A lot of the politics are in Washington, but the way it's actually being done is out in these field offices of the FBI. And in the case of New York, a lot happens here. I mean, now it looks like we're brilliant to have me based here, given, you know, the Times Square bombing and the Najib Al-Azazi, the guy who wanted to bomb the New York City subways. We also have two organizations here who are really focused on terrorism. Besides the FBI, the NYPD has its own counterterrorism intelligence unit. So there's a lot of fodder there for me to dig into.
Your job obviously requires a high level of secrecy, and I'm sure you develop relationships with the FBI and the CIA. How do you work up that trust with your sources there and still maintain your journalistic boundaries that allows you to do your job?
Well, two things. I think that writing the book helped because it was a long-term project, and they saw at the end of it, sort of everybody was equally squirrely about it. So some people in Lackawanna didn't like it in some ways, and the FBI didn't like it in other ways, which means probably I got it about right, because if one group or the other had loved it, I would have been more concerned that maybe I wasn't balanced. Mm. I think the other part of it, too, is you know, my job is not to throw a wrench into investigations. I think my job is to report on those investigations and explain what's going on behind the scenes and make sure that, you know, the rules are being followed in terms of, you know, the FBI has certain rules. Are they following those rules in terms of wiretaps, in terms of following people and that sort of thing? And in a 24-hour news cycle, a lot of that responsibility, the responsibility of being on the inside sometimes of an investigation gets lost, and people report things before they need to. Certainly during the Faisal Shahzad case, which was the Times Square bomber, there was so much information that was going out before this guy was even arrested. I mean, one of the reasons he almost got away was that he was following the news stories on the internet and saw that they were closing in on him and borrowed a neighbor's car and drove to JFK and almost got away.
And when that happens, that premature reporting, does that affect you and your job and what you could potentially get as far as information when you see so many of our news organizations jumping the gun?
Well, I don't want to cast aspersions on anyone, but I will tell you that I did know the name of Faisal Shahzad before it was made public, and I did know where he was in Connecticut and that he was being watched 2 days before he was actually arrested. And we talked about it, my editor and I. His name is Bruce Oster, and he's a former reporter as well. And we talked about the value of putting that out. And it was sort of a no-brainer for us because we didn't want to get in the way of the investigation. And frankly, the only people who would have known Faisal Shahzad were maybe his circle of friends and maybe neighbors on either side of him. And that would have been kind of meaningless to a listener if I had said this guy in Shelton, Connecticut is who they're looking for, if you know what I mean. It's sort of it's trying to sort of show off how good your reporting is as opposed to whether or not that reporting is really worthwhile.
Right. I know you've heard the old saying, you get more with sugar than with vinegar. I don't describe your relationship somewhat with organizations like the FBI and CIA. Does getting information work better using sugar or vinegar?
Well, I'm a sugar reporter, so I don't know. I've never really done the vinegar thing. Mm-hmm. It gets you all spooled up for no reason, and I try to minimize the spooling up of myself for no reason. I guess I would say, actually, in the Faisal Shahzad case I was just talking about, I probably got a lot of kudos behind the scenes from law enforcement who knew I knew the name and knew I was sitting on it because I wanted to wait until he was arrested. And when he, in fact, when he was arrested, I got a phone call within minutes of his being arrested from one of my sources who said, okay, he's arrested. You can go with it now.
Interesting. How, Al-Qaeda, how has the organization changed over the past few years? Have recruiting efforts remained consistent, or is this an evolving organization?
Well, I think what makes it so hard to fight is that it's an evolving organization. And now when we talk about Al-Qaeda, we almost have to put adjectives in front of it. You know, are we talking about core Al-Qaeda? Are we talking about affiliate groups from Al-Qaeda? I mean, when we talk about core Al-Qaeda, we're thinking of Osama bin Laden, which frankly, right now, this is sort of an idea out there as opposed to his giving any sort of orders to people as far as we can tell. And these affiliate groups are people who have sort of embraced his ideas, whether they're anti-Western or that there's a war on Islam. That's what these affiliate groups are about. And those are the ones who are giving us problems now in the United States. When you think of, for example, Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, he was sent by an affiliate group. He was sent by a group in Pakistan. When you think about the who we call the underwear bomber, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, the young Nigerian who was on that that plane bound for Detroit on Christmas Day when he tried to ignite a bomb from his underwear, he was sent by an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen. That's more and more what we're looking at. And I was speaking to an intelligence person about a week or so ago about the changing face of Al-Qaeda. And one of the things that he said is the way he thinks Al-Qaeda works with the affiliates now is it's sort of like a college student. You know, your freshman year of college, your parents tell you to do things and you do them. And by sophomore and junior year, your parents tell you to do things and they seem more like suggestions than actual orders. And in this case, Al-Qaeda core is really just making suggestions. It's not in a position to give any orders.
I read a comment from Stephen Flynn, president of the Center for National Policy, saying Al-Qaeda and its affiliates are shifting to a war of attrition. What are your thoughts on that statement? Is that an indication of changes taking place within the Al-Qaeda organization?
Well, the Al-Qaeda organization has always been changing. I'm not sure war of attrition is the way I would look at it. I think there are two basic ways to look at what's happening with Al-Qaeda today. One is that core Al-Qaeda that I'd been talking about, Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri, those folks, basically don't have a lot of power now and would love to have some sort of big attack, but are back on their heels because of the drone attacks that are going on in the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The affiliate groups just want really all they're capable of doing are smaller attacks because that's the infrastructure they have, that's the money they have, that's the access they have. And as a result, the only way I can see war of attrition is that we're now, instead of having 9/11 kind of attacks, these sort of big, brazen attacks, they're going to be smaller things like a car bomb that doesn't work that was parked in Times Square, or maybe we'll start to see some sort of suicide bombing. But we're going to see things that are much smaller in the future, I think.
Criticisms have been plentiful for the way the current administration has responded to the threat of homegrown terrorists. Are those criticisms justified? Maybe use this to talk a little bit about changes you've seen from the previous Bush administration to the way the Obama administration has handled this threat.
I'm not sure there's really been very much change between. I mean, there's sort of a change in tenor and words chosen, but in the brass tacks of the counterterrorism policy really hasn't changed very much. In fact, the drone attacks, which I think is sort of the cornerstone of the policy right now because they're not quite sure what else to do, have actually stepped up quite a bit under President Obama. So I'm not sure the policy has changed. I think that their hands are a little tied, to be perfectly honest, and I think that there's so much that's on the Obama administration's plate, given two wars, given the economic troubles, that they've done what they've had to sort of stamp out fires. But I don't know that they've really figured out a strategy that's all its own to fight terrorists who might want to come to the United States and do us harm.
If you've just joined us, our guest today is Dina Temple-Raston, the counterterrorism correspondent for National Public Radio. Dina is the keynote speaker at Grinnell College's Rosenfield Program in Public Affairs, International Relations, and Human Rights Symposium that takes place this Thursday at Grinnell. So many strands and different levels of sophistication when we examine the subject of terrorism. How much does racism play into the way we perceive terrorism in the U.S. and maybe even the way it's investigated?
It's interesting because I think Islamophobia was not something that I really focused on very much until this whole Park 51 mosque in New York sort of flared up, and this Quran burning in Florida flared up. And then all of a sudden, sort of a lot of feelings seemed to come to the fore. I mean, my whole book, The Jihad Next Door, was all about this exact problem. And I thought of doing this book after I realized that I was sitting on a plane and some very devout Muslims came on, and they were dressed, and the woman was wearing a hijab and an abaya, and I felt myself stiffen, wondering if I needed to be suspicious of these people. And theoretically, I'm enlightened, right? I know more about this, and I still had that visceral reaction. I mean, I don't have that reaction anymore, but I did then, and it made me think that if I'm having that reaction, there's got to be a lot of people who are also having that reaction. I think that the recent sort of flare-ups have made it look like we're much more Islamophobic than I think the country actually is. I think there was a timing issue. I think right now everything flares up, partly because of Tea Party issues, partly because of politics. And so it made it look much worse than it actually is. And I'm hoping that there will be some sort of climb down from that soon.
One of your reports, I think from maybe the spring, detailed how terrorist organizations can sometimes die out or, in a sense, burn out. The report, I think, pointed to when groups feel their attacks are not getting them any closer to their goal. Is Al-Qaeda anywhere near a burnout period or closer than maybe it was when we look back 10 years ago?
Well, I'm always an optimist, but I'm not sure I would say that Al-Qaeda is near a burnout period. I think what's important, what we're seeing with Al-Qaeda, is that it is losing popular support in the Muslim world. In fact, there were some numbers that came out, some polling that came out, and Al-Qaeda has actually killed more Muslims than it has Westerners or Americans. And so really the war that Al-Qaeda is waging, the casualties of that war have been Muslims. And this happened, you know, I did some reporting for NPR in Iraq, and one of the things that one of the reasons why Al-Qaeda in Iraq did not fare well, although it's starting to rise a little bit again, was because the people it was killing with all these car bombs weren't necessarily American soldiers. They were ordinary Iraqis. And Iraqi said, enough. I think there's some of that going on with Al-Qaeda now, too, where Muslims, particularly in Pakistan, for example, where a lot of Pakistanis may not love the Americans, but they think that Al-Qaeda has drawn a bead on them as much as they have the Americans.
This is a great segue when you mentioned Iraq. You provided a number of reports from Iraq. What was it like trying to do your job in such a volatile region of the world when everything was happening over there and you were essentially that was your workplace?
Well, I've done lots of crazy things in my career. I've it's just the most recent of the crazy things I've done, you know, to write the Lackawanna book. I was in Pakistani and jihadi hotels. I snuck across the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan at Spin Boldek because the Lackawanna Six did. And I thought to walk the walk and really understand what they'd done, I had to do what they did. I was in Kandahar when it was overrun with the Taliban just before suicide bombings really began down there in earnest. I drove the road between Kandahar and Kabul, which is essentially looks like the New Jersey Turnpike to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So it was at that time a really good road, but incredibly dangerous, and did that. So Iraq was sort of more it was just another thread in that fabric for me. That said, when I was there was when there was the siege on Basra, and there was a lot of violence there, a lot of mortars, and it was super dangerous. We had to be really careful. People who are working in Iraq are under constant, have to be careful, have to be constantly vigilant because of just how dangerous it is. And it makes it very hard to do your job. You know, NPR doesn't talk very much about how we do it, because we don't want to put people in danger, but there's a huge team there for us, both Iraqi and foreign, that really risk their lives every day to bring you the stories that you're hearing from Iraq.
I think I heard you say in an interview that NPR's news organization is much different than many others. And I think it may have been in the context of your reporting in Iraq. Without revealing too much, what makes NPR so different in their news organization, the way they work with producers and reporters?
Ooh, I can't even talk about it. It's just something that we do it in a really different way than other people do. We use locals in a way that's different than other people do. A lot of it has to do with security. Some of it, to be perfectly honest, some of it has changed since I was there a couple of years ago. So even if what I were going to tell you, I don't know what's sensitive and what's not, because we've moved from where we were and that sort of thing. So I prefer not to talk about that. Sorry.
Back to Iraq real quick, with America essentially moving out permanently, hopeful for the survival of that country and with what you've seen over there?
Well, I'm always hopeful. That's sort of my personality. I think that we're going to go through a rough period. I think the same thing's going to happen in Afghanistan. I was sitting down with an Afghan reporter just over the weekend who was visiting the United States, and he said this was a real pinnacle moment for Afghanistan. I think it's a real pinnacle moment for Iraq, too. They're both incredibly complicated and difficult situations, and we're in them, so we need to figure out how to extract ourselves from them. And for the most part, it seems like that's more or less working in Iraq, and I think in the next 6 months we'll realize whether or not that has worked in Afghanistan as well.
Covering terrorism, reporting from Iraq, what does Dina Temple Raston do to relax and escape from your work?
I know it sounds crazy, but my work is really fun. And I get to meet lots of really interesting people who don't necessarily have the same views I do. Mm-hmm. So I learn a lot. And for fun, what I do is I sail on weekends. I'm out of New York, but I sail in the Long Island Sound. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, so everyone there sort of sails. And I still do that, and that's what I do to relax. I run a lot. I have a big dog. That helps, too. But, you know, it's I haven't done something dangerous like Iraq in some time. And when I go and report on all these various things, it's quite thrilling because it's almost like you're pulling back the curtain on something everyone's very interested in, but no one gets sort of that sidewalk level view of what's going on. You know, there's a guy named Adnan Shukrujuma, and Shukrujuma is considered perhaps the number three in al-Qaeda, and he's American. And he grew up partly in Brooklyn and partly in Florida. And this weekend, I sat and talked to his mom. I mean, who gets to do that? And it was fascinating. It was a fascinating conversation, not about her son possibly being a terrorist, but qualities her son had and how she viewed what people were seeing and saying about her son. Even the FBI and the CIA have trouble getting a straight answer for somebody like that. And I get to do it for a living. So it's pretty fun.
A great example of how close you get to the human element of your reporting. Out in the world, we hear these stories about the terrorist cells and activities, and the human element is about the last thing on our mind when we try and make a connection with this.
And it's the first thing in my mind, because if we want to understand what's going on in this country and why people are deciding that they want to train and possibly attack this country and come back and possibly attack, we need to understand what makes them tick. And I think in the past, this had a lot more to do with religion than it does now. I think that before, you know, the Lackawanna Six steeped themselves in the Quran and tried to memorize bits of it and really tried to understand the Islamic religion to the best of their ability. What we're seeing now are people more like Jihad Jane. Do you remember she was the woman from Philly, the blonde sort of middle-aged woman who, you know, was arrested for possibly wanting to go and kill this Danish cartoonist. Her boyfriend said, and this is her live-in boyfriend, didn't even know she was Muslim. And no, she wasn't connected to any mosque. And yet she's known as so-called Jihad Jane. So you've got to, I think that there's a progression here where we're almost talking more about young men looking for something to belong to, and in her case, a middle-aged woman looking for someone to belong to, somewhere to belong. And in her case, I think it just as easily could have been a bright, shiny object that was white supremacy, for example. And if that's the way terrorism is sort of moving in this country, there's an advantage to that because law enforcement knows how to fight gangs or has some idea how to fight it. And I think the Islamic portion of terrorism has always sort of left them a little bit off balance because they didn't quite understand it. So in that respect, I think that the law enforcement piece of this is going to get more and more traction if this is the trend it takes.
Before we let you go, I just want to ask, so many tremendous books from you. Is there anything in the works in the near future?
Ooh, that's a secret too. But yeah. Yes, there may be something. I'm working on a little something and see if I can get it off the ground. This time it would be fiction.
Very good. Dina Temple-Raston, we so appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me. It was really nice talking to you.
Iowa Public Radio's Jeff Schmidt and his conversation with NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston. Temple-Raston will speak Thursday at 11 a.m. at Grinnell College's Rosenfield Program in Public Affairs. She will offer commentary entitled Behind the Scenes, Terrorism Cases After the Cold War. Coming up next on The Exchange, I talk with Nathan Timmel, a stand-up comedian from North Liberty. Timmel is back in the States after a third trip entertaining U.S. troops in Iraq. Nathan Timmel, next on The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa is one of just two states in the nation that has never elected a woman to Congress or as governor. One of two states in the nation. Tomorrow on this program, we talk about the organization 50-50 in 2020. Their goal, by the year 2020, Iowa should elect females to fill 50% of the Iowa legislature, 50% of the congressional delegation, and occupy the office of the governor. We'll talk about this effort tomorrow on our program, as well as Sarah Palin's visit to Iowa. My next guest is professional comedian Nathan Timmel. He's been serving this country abroad, not as a soldier, but as a comedian. He's been doing his stand-up for over a decade across the country, and in recent years since 2004, been invited to go to both Iraq and Afghanistan several times to perform for U.S. troops. Nathan Timmel has just returned from another tour, another trip to Iraq from September 1st through the 12th. He was performing many, many gigs for the troops. Nathan Timmel is in our studio in Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Welcome back to our program, Nathan.
Hello, hello.
So tell us about this one. It was, where did you go in Iraq?
I can tell you, but I have to admit that you piqued my interest. I want to know what the other state is that doesn't elect women. You can't just toss that out there and leave
you'll
everyone
you'll
hanging.
You'll have to tune in tomorrow, Nathan. That's I know you're a public radio listener. You'll be tuned in probably anyway.
Mean. It's like the end of Inception. You just leave everybody wondering.
Where were you in Iraq this time?
Southern Iraq this time. Flew into Kuwait, performed a couple shows there, and then flew into a major base, Basra, in Iraq, and then flew out to several smaller bases.
In this nearly 2 weeks of being there, how many shows did you do?
I'm more than a handful. I don't keep track. If I had a one,
so
two, four,
several,
five, six, seven,
several,
eight,
several a day.
No, not several a day. Not anymore. That was back as bases shut down. Back in 2004, we would do several a day because we had so many bases there. Now we're shutting them down, so it was just one a day. And I think we had a day off in there sometimes. So
And you're flown around still via Black Hawk helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
From one base to the next. Now, recently, of course, President Obama announced the end of combat operations in Iraq. What are some of the changes that you've noticed? You were there in 2004 the first time at the really height. There were 160 up nearly 200,000 there. Now we're down to below 50,000. What are the differences you're seeing when you return there as an observer, someone who's not part of the military?
I actually think the major differences I noticed came from last year to this year when I went over in 2009 to this year, because last year everything felt still enormous and just sort of blasé. We'd been there so long that people were used to it and they just sort of went around their routine, and we still had a multitude of bases. This year with the drawdown, I discovered that people still have the same duties, the same orders to carry out, but there are far fewer people doing it, and that leads to a higher level of stress. I mean, we keep closing bases, and I'm not going to give numbers because I don't think that would be appropriate, but we're moving Apache helicopters into Afghanistan, so we have much fewer that have to cover the whole country. I was taken to a base that had, I think, the only Apache outpost, and they said that if we get called in to cover a convoy or that there's action taking place up north, it literally one base has to fly up there. So the stress level is actually higher now, even though we're in a time of supposed peace, than it was a little while ago.
Mm-hmm. How many indications of evidence of combat did you get while you were there?
Oh, I don't know about evidence. We were taken on maneuvers. I discovered that after the end of it. We were waiting for our Blackhawks to pick us up at a base, and they took over an hour to get us. They were late, and when we were flying to the base we were supposed to go to, our home base, they paused over the town outside it and started doing looping circles. There are two Blackhawks. They fly in pairs, and they would swoop sideways over the ground, and the gunner would lean out and examine the ground. And at the time, I was just thinking, hey, that's neat. They're showing off for the comics. And what I found out when I got back is the reason they were late is the base that we were staying at had been shelled two nights in a row, one night before we got there and one night when we were there, and they had received intel that a white pickup truck, someone was launching it from the back and staying mobile of this white pickup truck. So they were told to drop the comics off and then fly out and look for this truck. Well, pilots were, however exciting you might think it might be to be a Blackhawk pilot, and oh my, it'd be great to fly around. To them, it's just a job, and they get bored. So they decided, well, instead of taking the comics back, dropping them off, and adding all this time to their day, let's just take a look with them in the back. So I didn't realize it, but I was actually on maneuvers as they looked for this white pickup truck, which was
wow.
Interesting.
Now, I don't know how much contact you have with troops, but how has that changed morale, if at all, this drawdown? That's happening in Iraq?
Well, as I said, people seem more stressed. And one thing I think that leads to the stress, and this is just personal opinion from talking to them, is for a long time we've been hearing this phrase that Iraq is a new democracy and it's going to grow up. It's going to go through some growing pains. And I would say right now it's in its teenage years. So we, quote, liberated them from Saddam Hussein, and we might feel proud of that. But what Iraq is feeling right now, the army, the soldiers, is they're sort of getting big-chested and like, you know, hey, we can take care of ourselves. Like I've been told stories of two convoys, an American convoy and an Iraqi convoy meeting on a road going in opposing directions, and neither one will back down. The Iraqis are like, this is our country. You get out of our way. Pull off the road. And the mm-hmm. Americans are like, hey, come on. We liberated you. We need to get, you know, you pull over. And the funny thing about it, and so that's kind of frustrating to deal with, is we're supposed to be a partnership, and yet we're getting told sort of like, you know, leave us alone until, of course, the gunfire starts. Then it's, hey, call in the Americans. We need backup. Hmm. And the soldiers are frustrated like that. They feel they don't get the respect they deserve when there isn't battle. And then they're called immediately when they need backup, when the Iraqis need backup. And I would like to point this out, that I only talk to American soldiers. I'm sure there are Iraqi soldiers that are willing to die for their country and very proud. I just didn't hear that side of the story. So I don't want to make it seem like I'm slamming Iraq too harshly.
If you just joined us, my guest for the remainder of the hour is professional comedian Nathan Timmel. Lives in North Liberty, has been serving the troops, U.S. troops, since 2004, multiple times, trips to Afghanistan and Iraq to perform for the troops. And if you have a question for Nathan Timmel, perhaps you'd like to ask some certain aspect about performing, visiting Afghanistan, visiting the troops and Iraq, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. You arrived in Kuwait at the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, the holy month where Muslims refrain from eating, drinking, sexual relations from dawn until sunset. Did that affect being in a Muslim country during Ramadan? Did that affect how things proceeded as far as you were concerned, or are you sort of isolated, walled off from what is a Muslim holy month?
For the most part, Kuwait, you know, we are allowed to be off base in Kuwait if we wanted to go visit town. You're allowed to do that. We didn't really do it this time. I'd been out shopping or to restaurants there in the past, but this time, what you have to understand is that Kuwait's a kingdom. It's not a democracy. So even though I am not Muslim, I was subject to Muslim rule, meaning I was told in advance, when you land, don't bring water off the plane, don't be seen eating an energy bar in the airport. When you are in a military vehicle riding between bases, you have to respect the sun-up to sundown rules of Ramadan, or you'll be arrested and thrown in jail. And I thought that was very interesting, considering what was happening here in the States when I left, which was the controversy over the community center in New York and the idiot mustache pastor in Florida who wanted to burn the Quran. Mm-hmm. In that protesters here in America saying that, oh, no mosque in New York, they don't understand what freedom really is, because when you go to a non-free country like Kuwait and you are subject to their rules, even though they shouldn't apply to you, like, well, I'm not Muslim, I'm thirsty, I should, you know, replenish my fluids with water. And to go to jail for that, it's absurd.
Mm-hmm. And so some are saying in this country that if the center is allowed to be built, it would be seen as a victory over the U.S., sort of a 9/11 victory, to plant a flag in 9/11. And you're saying,
when in reality, I think it's a victory for freedom, showing that we do allow freedom of religion and even the freedom of nut jobs to protest and be angry over something they probably know very little about. Mm-hmm. They just, you know, rabble, 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 no mosque, no mosque, rabble, rabble, rabble.
1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our first caller is Tom in Iowa City. Good afternoon, Tom. Welcome to the exchange.
Thanks, Ben. This is off the subject. Well, it's on the subject right now, that brouhaha about the community center. It's just so much of a mountain out of a molehill. I think it's ludicrous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People shouldn't have even started protesting it. Anyway, my question was, for Nathan, many of us older people know that probably the most famous comic entertainer for the
Bob Hope.
Yes, I don't know if you guys mentioned it because I haven't had the radio on the whole time. But I was wondering if Nathan maybe watched a lot of his routines to kind of figure out how to do the one-liners, or, you know, use Hope as a sort of a mentor.
Tom, great question. So Bob Hope, who others influence you in perhaps comedians who have also performed in wartime?
I actually cannot say. I mean, I'm obviously familiar with Bob Hope, but not too familiar with. I know his one-liners, but he I can't say he was too much of an influence on me. I came up in the 70s and was more interested in Richard Pryor and George Carlin and the storytelling style of comedy, where I don't really have one-liners. I tell stories about my life, my childhood, my ideas, my beliefs, and I try and keep it very personal, so that the hope is, and I could be wrong, that I'm being original by talking about me. I can't, and no one can say, "Oh, you stole that joke." Really? It happened when I was six. I can't really say I stole that.
Tom, thank you for your question.
You're welcome, man.
Tom in Iowa City. 1-866-780-9100. Nathan Timmel with us, a professional comedian from Iowa who has taken many trips to Iraq and Afghanistan on behalf of our troops to entertain them, just returned a few days ago from his latest tour in Iraq. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Tom's question brings to mind, how do you approach comedy for an audience of U.S. troops in Iraq or Afghanistan differently than if that audience were civilians stateside?
The only difference I would say I make is I'm just aware of my surroundings, such as if I had a joke about traffic, I probably wouldn't, you know, I could do it, but I wouldn't try and relate it to them. Sometimes in the States, you talk to the audience, you talk to any audience, but you can say, you know, something wacky like, "Hey, isn't traffic sure crazy? Waka waka." And then you do your joke about traffic. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a military audience in Iraq, you're like, "Hey, isn't traffic? Oh, you don't really deal with that, do you? You do what you want, or you drive tanks. It doesn't really." So you just sort of just be aware of your surroundings at all.
Are there any no-go themes that you would say?
The list you get are bashing the commander in chief, no matter who it is.
This is from the military.
Yeah, they pretty much say that no matter who, you know, I've been there under both Obama and Bush, so I suppose I'm supposed to put president in front of both of those names for respect, President Obama and President Bush. And you weren't allowed to talk about the commander in chief in a disparaging way, and I think the N-word is frowned upon because they would get Def Jam comics over there that use it in their act. They're black already, so they would like, "Hey, you know," but that's forbidden, even if that is part of your act. And the last one is, even with Don't Ask, Don't Tell being big, they try and stay shy away from anything either pro or anti-homosexual material. Just don't talk about it. Keep it exactly like they like it in the military, that don't even joke about it. Don't even mention it.
So your jokes about same-sex couples, same-sex marriage would just not be present at any of these shows.
Yeah, I just don't talk about it. I try to stay apolitical in front of troops anyway, because I try to stay apolitical in audience. Well, no, I don't know. I guess I get political in front of American audiences, but without an opinion. I don't let my political beliefs come out in the way that I either support or do not support a candidate or a party.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been a professional comedian for 12 years, is that right?
Yes.
And since 2004, you've been entertaining the troops off and on. That would be a couple times a year, or at least once a year.
Yeah, hopefully once a year.
Something like that. How would you say that's changed you as a comedian?
Oh, goodness. I don't know if it would change me as a person, and then that changes me as a comedian.
So start with the person.
I know the first time I ever went overseas, I was not a very flag-wavy sort of, you know, go military American until the first tour I took, where I got to meet a lot of the people that signed up for this and really got to respect and love them for what they do and be impressed by the brotherhood created the uniform. The uniform represents that came out inelegantly. Just basically, God, the word cult popped into my mind, and that's why I paused. It's not a brotherhood is the best thing, to be there and to see the uniform and how that creates a bonding between people wearing it. Really impressed me, really touched me, and it made me come home differently with the respect for the people that wear that uniform.
Mm-hmm. I noticed on your website, nathantimmel.com, that you also have a video there. You did a little exercise with some of the troops. This is some time ago, but holding up my "Hi, Mom" placards.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't call that an exercise. It was I did that last year in 2009. I got a bug in my butt walking through Target. I was by the office section, and I saw not paperboard, but the sort of thicker construction paper, and I wrote "Hi, Mom" on it, and had every troop that wanted to hold it up and wave "Hi, Home."
You put some music to it, yeah. Peter Mulvey's music mm-hmm. To that.
This time, the video I posted is I got to get attacked by a puppy in a canine training unit. So they put me in one of those big outfits.
Is that on the website now?
It's not on my website. It's on my YouTube. I can put it on my website. My website has the long form blog I've written about this last tour right now. But yeah, I got dolled up in a. It was actually, I can't lie, it was slightly disappointing. They were so worried about a lawsuit or hurting me that they got the smallest dog they could to attack me, and he couldn't even bring me down, and I actually swung him around a bit and got yelled at. They're like, "Hey, don't swing the dog." I'm like, "Really? You're going to tell an insurgent not to swing the dog around?" I enjoyed it. It was fun watching him, you know, munch on my arm, but they're like, "Oh, if you feel the jaws too tight, yell and we'll make him stop." I'm like, "I can't feel the jaws at all. Get me a bigger dog. I want him to take me down." I thought it'd be fun.
Nathan Timmel, my guest. He's just returned from Iraq, entertaining the troops. Now, with the drawdown of the military in Iraq, military bases are being turned over to the Iraqi army. You don't have any contact with the Iraqi army, but do you see any evidence of how that's going?
Well, very interesting. Some of the bases we turn over that used to be exclusively American now are Iraqi, but we keep a small little section in the corner of the base. But it's not open-aired. It's not just like Americans and Iraqis walking around. We actually erect huge concrete walls. I think they're called T-walls. I'm not positive. To cordon off a section so that we are a base or a compound within a base. Mm-hmm. And we landed at one called Eastern Barracks. And I thought this was interesting flying in that they set up two American guards on the perimeter on their knees with guns pointed out towards the Iraqi section, you know, full
towards our allies.
Towards our allies. And I asked about it. I said, "What?" And they said, "Well, you know, we trust them. They're our friends. But they know that anybody coming in on a helicopter is generally a VIP. I'm like, "Well, they were wrong this time. That must be disappointing. You know, imagine if they'd taken a shot at one of us, like, oh, we're going to get a general." Oh, it was just a comic. But the whole point was these are our allies, and they were, you know, taking all precautions. When we had to leave, we sat inside an MRAP for an hour. They did not want us sitting outside on the landing pad in the open Iraqi area.
An MRAP is a?
It's the upgrade from the Humvee. When all the Humvees were getting blown up because they didn't have armor, the MRAP is the larger, more armored, can take a IED blast.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept us in that because they didn't want us out in the open air.
Do you ever have some serious moments on stage? You're there to uplift, entertain, make them laugh. Does it ever happen that you find someone out in the audience you connect with, or something happens that turns it more serious, or do you just avoid that altogether?
I don't know if you can avoid it, but fortunately, knock on wood, I have. I haven't had a serious moment on stage. They all take place off stage during conversations where you find out interesting facts about people where, yeah, not on stage, but one thing I discovered that I thought was serious, a lot of Americans don't understand that the troops are still over there. When one soldier talked about this, suddenly I asked a bunch, and everyone had the same comment, was back here in America, their families were being greeted by neighbors and friends saying, "Oh, you must be so happy that your son or daughter is home." And they would say, "No, he is still over in Iraq." Because people read headlines. They see combat ended in Iraq, but what they don't read is two paragraphs in, 50,000 troops remain. And I've actually gotten a couple emails since then on the same subject saying they're very frustrated having to explain. The soldiers are very frustrated having to explain over and over, "You don't understand. I'm still here. I am still stationed. I'm still in danger. Don't treat it like I'm home or that, you know, Iraq is a cakewalk now."
Mm-hmm. Now, what other types of things don't we hear about in the media generally that jumped out at you going over there that you would surprise us if we were consuming mainstream media here?
The two things, and probably you talk serious, the most depressing. Last year I discovered that suicide was increasing greatly among troops in Iraq, or in the military overall. I can't just limit it to one area. And I read a story, these are very small stories, you'd think they'd be front page news, that said June of this year had the highest rate of suicides in the military. And I thought that was depressing, that it seems underreported. But the most depressing thing, and I really have no way of talking about this, is one of the bases I visited, they said that they had 10 instances of rape in 1 month, military-on-military rape. Actually, 9 was military-on-military, 1 was outside the
realm of that. So these are male soldiers raping female soldiers?
Yes, and I really have no way to talk about it, no way to combat. I did go to another base where We visited the hospital, and they actually had condoms at the hospital, which I thought was at least a sort of silent way of saying, look, if you guys, you know, we don't openly promote sexual fraternization, but, you know, if you're going to do, but other than that, other than making condoms available, I don't know how it's dealt with in the military. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't see it reported outside the military.
Nathan Timmel, we have less than a minute left. Tell us, do you keep up any communication with soldiers you meet over there?
Absolutely, yeah. Interesting to go to from rape to friendship, but sure, let's do it. The global phenomenon of Facebook, I get friended on there by soldiers that have seen me, and we exchange emails. I have a couple friends from past tours going back to Afghanistan in 2005 that I still email with every few weeks.
Okay. Nathan Timmel, thank you very much. We've run out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming into our studio. Tell us about your latest trip to Iraq. We want to remind our listeners to find out more about Nathan Timmel, nathantimmel.com. Thanks, Nathan.
Yeah.
The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.